Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
We're continuing our study in 1 Kings. We're going to be in 1 Kings 22. I think it's an extremely interesting study, terribly difficult about all that happens here. And I want to give you a few resources that I hope you'll purchase in your study of the Old Testament. Verse 1 is very significant because it tells us about a bit of history. We don't have too much information from the Bible. Matter of fact, a lot of information about this particular event comes from the black obelisk of Salmaneser III, the king of Assyria, who talks about this his invasion into the Transjordan area and the coalition of kings of Assyria and others, and apparently Israel was a part of this. One of my favorite books on history, it's somewhat dated now, but I still like it and trust it very much, is The History of Israel by John Bright. I've had to glue mine together. I've used it so much. It has a great index. I hope you'll think about getting this history. Some scholars would say that Albright and Bright, two American archaeologists, have been totally repudiated, but I think that's not true. I still like a lot that they've done in their attempt to combine archaeology and the biblical narrative. And here it helps tremendously when we know about what happened. Apparently we learned that Israel sent 10,000 soldiers and 2,000 chariots into this coalition to stop Assyria. Now, although Assyria claims victory, we know that really most of her expansionism tendencies at the headwaters of the Euphrates were stopped for over 5 years because of this coalition. But now the coalition is over, and apparently Israel is mad at Syria because of a city in Gilead, Ramoth-Gilead, that was supposed to be returned to Israel after the agreement between Ben-Hadad, the king of Damascus, or Syria, and never was. It became a source of tension, and now Judah and Israel are going to ally themselves together and fight against Syria. And that's what we learn in verse 2. And apparently this had been the first meeting of these two groups since the split back between Jeroboam and Rehoboam, Solomon's son, Rehoboam, and the Ephraimic labor leader, Jeroboam I, the son of Nebat. Now, notice it says, in about that third year, Jehoshaphat, he's a godly king of the south. Much great things are said about him. And the king of Judah came down to the king of Israel. Now, I thought that Jerusalem was below Samaria. Well, theologically speaking in the Bible, everything is down from the city of Jerusalem. So even though for us it'd be up to, in their sense, it was down. A parallel to this can be seen in 2 Chronicles chapter 18, verse 2. The only thing Jehoshaphat's really condemned for is this alliance with the king of the north. Okay? We learn that later on that Ahab's daughter, Athaliah, is going to marry Jehoshaphat's son, Jehoram. You might want to see 2 Kings 8 or 2 Chronicles 18, 1. And that's going to be a real problem because Athaliah is going to be the one woman who tries to usurp the throne of Judah. She was much like her mother Jezebel was. And again, this book I showed you about on the history of Israel on page 222 says that really this was not Ahab's daughter, but his sister. And I hope you'll get John Bright's book, A History of Israel, and look at page 222. Now, the king of Israel said to his servants, "Do you know that Ramoth-Gilead belongs to us?" Now, we know that during Solomon's time, this was one of the capitals of his district of Bashan. You might want to compare this to chapter 20, verse 34. "And we are still doing nothing to take it out of the hands of the king of Syria." And he said to Jehoshaphat, "Will you go with me to battle at Ramoth-Gilead?" This is what Jehoshaphat said without even consulting God. "I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses." What a rash kind of statement that is from this godly king. My goodness, that was dumb. And he's going to pay a price for it. "Moreover, Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, 'Please inquire first for the word of the Lord.'" He's already made this rash promise, and now he kind of wants God to bless his plans. That's kind of what's happening here. But at least he believed that God should be a part of the system, which Ahab probably would not even have thought about. Now, it says, inquire. Who are they going to inquire? Well, earlier during David and Saul's time, they would have inquired of the priest, of the ephod, the Urim and the Thummim. But at this point in Israel's history, they would acquire of the prophets. And every one of these kings had court prophets, apparently. We know Ahab had his wife Jezebel from the encounter on Mount Carmel had 950 of these fertility prophets. Now, who are these prophets? Well, There seems to be some discrepancy because they use the name Adonai and the name Elohim, not the name Yahweh. Many have asserted they're the priest from the golden calf shrines at Dan to the north and Bethel to the south. And that probably seems to be true because one of them later on, down in verse 11, Zedekiah has the covenant name Yahweh in his name. So these at least are supposed to be prophets of Yahweh, not Baal worshippers. And the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 men. That's quite a few prophets to have, isn't it? And shall I go against Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I refrain? They said, go up, for the Lord will give it into your hand of the king. Now look at the word Lord there in verse 6. Do you see how it's a capital L, but not a capital O, R, or D? This is the word Adonai. We also learned from the 2 Chronicles chapter 18, 5, that the same parallel for this, they use the word Elohim, or capital G, God. So they're not using the covenant name for God here. And I think Jehoshaphat picked up on that. This is very similar to what happened in Jeremiah's day when all the king's prophets said peace and prosperity. And just Jeremiah said, no, this city's going to fall. We're going to find a prophet here who stood against the king and was also put in prison like Jeremiah was. So just because you speak the truth and just because you speak from God doesn't mean you're going to have health, wealth, and prosperity. You may speak the truth from prison, get chucked back in it. Now, sometimes speaking God's word is not all that safe. But Jehoshaphat said, is there not yet a prophet of Yahweh here that we may inquire? Now, surprisingly, why not Elijah? Where is Elijah? He's a prophet of Yahweh. Where are the 3,000 that haven't bowed a knee to Baal? Some of them are probably prophets. Where were they? We don't know. Maybe Elijah had disappeared again into the desert. We're not sure. But there was a prophet. His name is Micaiah. And he is mentioned here in verse 8. And apparently he is a prophet of the Lord and a good one. And the king's going to say, well, this guy's against me. He doesn't like me. He always prophesies negatively. Jehoshaphat says, let him speak. I want to hear what he has to say. Many the Jewish commentators try to identify Micaiah with the unnamed prophet of chapter 20, verse 42. And that may be possible, although it's not certain. And the king of Israel called an officer. Now, it says here, eunuch. Because we know from like Deuteronomy 23:1, how negative castrated persons were looked on in Israel, this later came to mean just a court official. Like in Genesis 39:1, Potiphar had a wife, and he's called this same name. So it originally may have meant eunuch, but it came to mean just a court official. And said, bring quickly Micaiah, son of Imlah. Now, of course, it implies later on that he was in prison and had to be brought. Now, the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, were sitting each on his throne, probably portable thrones, and arrayed in their robes. Oh, they were fancy. Oh, they looked good. Oh, they had all the official power of state there. At the threshing floor, a void place in front of the gate of Samaria, place of official meeting. Apparently, it was either just outside the gate or just inside. And all the prophets were prophesying. Oh, they're making wild gestures and all kind of things. 400 of them. What a scene this must have been. Then Zedekiah made horns of iron for himself. Now, he's going to kind of be a symbolic prophecy. He's going to either put them on his head and push like this, showing that the horns, animal horns, were a symbol of power. Matter of fact, it's interesting. In Deuteronomy 33:17, it says Ephraim has horns. And, of course, Ephraim is a symbol of Israel, the major tribe of Israel. And you can see how that prophecy may be pulling on that prophecy. With these you shall gore the Assyrians until they are consumed. And all the prophets were prophesying, saying, go up to Ramoth-Gilead and prosper, for the Lord. Now, they use the word Yahweh here because apparently they realized that Jehoshaphat wanted to hear that word from his religious men, and they kind of comply here, though earlier they were uncomfortable with it, apparently. And give it to the hand of the king. Then the messenger who went to summon Micaiah spoke to him, saying, behold now, the words of the prophets are uniformly favorable to the king. Please let your word be like the word of one of them. Now, this may imply something very interesting. Maybe these people thought that prophets not only spoke for God, but had the ability to manipulate God, to make God do what they wanted to, because this man actually thought that this prophet of Yahweh could change God's mind or something. But I want to tell you what, listen to what this prophet says. But Micaiah said, as the Lord lives, which is a play on the word Yahweh, I am that I am, Exodus 3:14, the Hebrew verb to be. What Yahweh says to me, I will speak. What he's saying is, friend, you don't threaten me. You don't tell me what to say. The Lord tells me to say. I'm not speaking out of my own thoughts, my own desires, what's best for me. When he came to the king said to him, Micaiah, shall we go to Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I refrain? And the prophet answered him, go up and succeed, and the Lord will give it into the hand of the king. Now, what's happening here? Does that mean that God was for this? No, not at all. Here's some of the theories of why he did that. The king's question was insincere, and the prophet answered insincere, kind of offhand. Maybe that by the tone of his voice, the gesture he made, he said, you've already made up your mind, king. Do what you want to. Maybe that's what he was saying. Some have said, Micaiah did what the king wanted him to do and say, just like the man had told him. Some say no. Ahab didn't want God's message, just wanted God's blessing on his plans. And others say this exactly fulfills the prophecy of verse 22 and 23 about that God's going to send a false message into all the prophets. And here Micaiah kind of fulfills that himself, saying, you wanted to hear this message? There. You've heard it. Now do what you want to anyway. Don't we do that a whole lot? We kind of make our plans, make our decisions, and want kind of God to bless it as we do what we want to? Not good. Not good. Then the king said to him, how many times must I adjure you to speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord? He uses the word Yahweh here. Now maybe he's saying this for Jehoshaphat's purposes. Maybe he didn't really mean that, but wanted Jehoshaphat to hear him say that. Or maybe this prophet had played games with him before and just told him what he wanted to hear, but later told him the truth. We're just not sure. And here's the prophecy. I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains like sheep which have no shepherd. Now, all Israel, this can mean both the north and the south, a collective term for Israel, but probably in this context with a separate nation of Judah and a separate nation of Israel, it means just the north. Now, scattered on the mountains refers to the Israeli army, and like a sheep that had no shepherd, refers to the king. The king is going to die. That's what this is talking about. And it's an obvious reference to that, and all the army will be dismissed. Then the king of Israel said, Jehoshaphat, did I not tell you that he would not prophesy good concerning me? Now, I think it's very interesting that the king is trying to set up Jehoshaphat by saying, this prophet's not going to tell you the truth. But Jehoshaphat said, no, I want to hear what he says. But Jehoshaphat had already made this rash promise of verse 4. Apparently, he was just not willing to go back on his word and look ridiculous. And even in the light of this prophecy from God's prophet, he is not going to respond appropriately. And Micaiah said, now this is a very, very, very difficult section. We seem as if God is advocating lying here. It's one of the strongest anthropomorphic passages on God anywhere in the Bible. So please follow with me. And Micaiah said, therefore, hear the word of the Lord, Yahweh. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, much like Isaiah 6. And all the host of heaven, this seems to be the angelic councils, much like the introduction to Job, all the angels came before God, something like that, standing by him on his right, on his left. And the Lord said, who will entice Ahab to go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said this, while another said that, this angelic council. This idea of the Lord wanting to entice a king to do something. Well, this is a very difficult passage, but I think, again, it's this Old Testament theology about one and only one source. God is the only God there is, and therefore good and evil are attributed to him. Light and darkness, calamity and blessing are all attributed to God in the older parts of the Old Testament. Please get a pencil and write these down so you can check out this and see it's a normal way for the older parts of the Old Testament to talk about God. Let's begin in Job chapter 2, verse 10. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 38. Isaiah 45, 7. Isaiah 54, 16. Lamentations 3, 38. Ezekiel 14, 9, a real important parallel. And Amos chapter 3, verse 6b. And I think that's one of the answer here. Now, notice what happens. One angel said this, another angel said that. And then, verse 21, not a spirit, but the spirit came forward and stood before Yahweh and said, I will entice him. In my opinion, this has got to be the evil one, the Satan, the accuser of men. It's very much like 1 Samuel 16, 14 and 15, an evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul. Now, the best discussion of Satan in the Old Testament that I've ever seen is this book called The Theology of the Old Testament by A.B. Davidson on page 300 and following. It says that originally in the Old Testament, Satan is not an arch enemy of God. It's kind of that angelic being that sifts men's motives. Men want to be right with God. This angel sifts their motives. this angel accuses men of not having the right attitude, accuses men of not being worthy of right standing with God. And I think as you see this development in the Bible, it's not till the New Testament this arch enemy comes. And it probably developed from this problem. Does everything come from God, good and evil? Or is there an evil source over here that's trying to hurt men and thwart God's plans? And so I think we see something of progressive revelation. I hope you'll get this. A.B. Davidson, The Theology of the Old Testament. Check it out of the library. Read this section on Satan, 300 through about 306. It is the best I've ever seen on the development of evil in the Old Testament and the Bible. Now, this the Spirit says, and the Lord said to him, how? He said, I will go out and be a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And he said, you are to entice him and also prevail. Go and do so. This same kind of thing, a deceiving spirit in the mouth of prophets, is seen in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 11 and 12, dealing with the Antichrist and the false prophets of the end time. God's going to give them a false message to give to the world. Now, this is the idea that God is in control of all things, even in control of evil. Folks, Satan would not exist if he was not in the will of God. There is not a Zoroastrian dualism in the universe. It's not light fighting darkness. God is in control of history, and God is in control of the evil one. Look at Job 1 and 2 again. Look at Zechariah chapter 3 again. God determines. And that's the basic thrust of these older parts of the Old Testament. There's just one source. Now, it seems to us, how can God be immoral like that? Folks, this is speaking about God as if he was a man, but we know that he's not. So it's an anthropomorphic phrase used to speak of one causality in the universe. Now, beginning in verse 24, then Zedekiah came near and struck Micaiah on the cheek and said, how did the Spirit of the Lord pass from me to you? Now, folks, it's obvious this Zedekiah thought he had a revelation from something outside of himself. Now, since Micaiah is obviously the Spirit of God, this one, this prophet, this Zedekiah, must be led by the forces of darkness, the evil one. He believed there was a force in him that spoke out of him, that led him, but it wasn't God. The man was sincere. He thought he was speaking from God, but he really wasn't. Now, notice, and Micaiah said to him, behold, you shall see on that day when you enter into the inner room and hide yourself. Now, this sounds a whole lot like what happened to Jesus. Jesus was slapped, of course, when he answered the high priest. Here's a prophet speaking the truth that's slapped by a false prophet. Sounds a whole lot like Hananiah and Jeremiah. False prophet and Jeremiah confronting each other. And this prophet said, you're going to see that what I'm saying is true, and when it is, you're going to go hide in your closet. Now, who's he going to hide from? Some say Jezebel. Some say his son, the new king. But this man's going to pay a price, and he'll know who speaks for God. Then the king of Israel said, take Micaiah and return him to Amon, the governor of the city, and to Joash, the king's son. Well, it was obviously he's in prison. Now, it sounds so funny to me that the governor of the city is mentioned before the king's son. We learn from several other passages in the Old Testament, this little phrase, the king's son, probably doesn't mean literally the king's son, but another high official, probably maybe a king's relative or something. Here are the other verses in the Bible where it's obvious the king's son does not refer to the king's son. Jeremiah, 36:26, Jeremiah 38:6, and 2 Chronicles 28:7. I hope you'll look at that. And feed him sparingly with bread and water until I return. Now, literally, this is the bread of affliction. That means mourner's bread, which means really bread and water and not much of that. Make him suffer for this prophecy, is what he's saying, until I return. It's the king's way of saying, I'll prove this guy doesn't speak for God. I'm going to come back. And until I do, you just feed him just enough to keep him alive in prison. Sometimes, friends, this health, wealth, and prosperity garbage just don't fit the book. Here's God's prophet speaking God's truth at God's timing, and he'll suffer for it. In a fallen world, you live for God, you'll pay a price. Notice then, and so the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went up against Ramoth-Gilead. Now, why did he do it in light of what he just heard? Some say because of his rash promise of verse 4. Some say his death wasn't predicted in the prophecy of verse 17. And others say he did not believe Micaiah was a true prophet. I'm not sure which it is. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, I will disguise myself and go into battle, but you put on your robes. Now, it's interesting to me, the Septuagint says, you put on my robes. It's obvious from early. Both the kings had their royal robes there as they sit on their thrones. Why is it possible that Ahab wanted Jehoshaphat to wear his robes? Well, that seems that seems too much to believe. Why would Jehoshaphat let this king be disguised? Maybe it was Ahab's way of trying to get rid of this prophecy, try to protect himself. We're just not sure. The fact Jehoshaphat agreed is what's amazing to all of us that read this. My soul, what a dummy. Now the king of Syria, verse 31, had commanded that 32 of his captains of his chariots, saying, "Do not fight with small or great, but with the king of Israel alone." That he meant attack him. There was some animosity between Ben-Hadad and Ahab. We don't know exactly what it was. It may have been something that happened earlier, something during the war with Assyria, something over Ramoth-Gilead. We're just not sure. But the king of Syria said, "You kill the king of Israel." That's what his orders are. So it came about when the captains of the chariot saw Jehoshaphat, they said, "Surely it's the king of Israel." And they turned aside to fight against him, and Jehoshaphat cried out. Now some say, how'd they know it wasn't him? Some say he cried his name. "I'm Jehoshaphat." Some say he cried Judah's battle cry. Some say he cried out for divine help. Matter of fact, that's what the parallel in 2 Chronicles 18:31 says, that God's the one that delivered him from this situation. Maybe he cried out God's name or something. Whatever, they found out it wasn't the king of Israel, and they turned aside from following him. Now, a certain man drew his bow at random and struck the king of Israel in the joint of his armor. You catch the providence of God? Well, a certain archer randomly shot an arrow. It just happened to hit right between the kinks in the armor. Oh, friend, God's in control of that arrow. God's in control of that archer. God's in control of history. That doesn't mean his prophet's not suffering back in prison. It means God's in control of the destiny not only of Israel, but we learn from others, of all, the destiny of all men. Now, he's wounded severely. He asked his charioteer to take him away from the battle, but the battle was so strong, he couldn't get away. And so they propped him up in the head of his troops, and he bled to death in that chariot. At evening, he died. And after they knew that he was dead, the men of Israel said, "Each man to his own tent, each man to his own house," as exactly the prophecy of Micaiah is fulfilled, chapter 22:17. And so the king died and was brought to Samaria, and they buried the king of Samaria. Now Josephus says that he was in the pool of Jezreel is where this blood was washed off, not the pool of Samaria in verse 38, because of the prophecy in chapter 21, verse 21:19 says it'll happen at Jezreel. Now, folks, I think if you'll look at that, apparently in chapter 21, verses 27 through 29, Ahab really repented of what he had done. And the Lord may have changed this prophecy because the man repented. We're just not sure, but it doesn't exactly fit the prophecy of 21:19. It says the dogs licked his blood. The Septuagint says the swines and the dogs. The harlots bathed there. Oh, yuck, kind of show the uncleanness of this. Now, King James says they washed his armor, but literally it's where the harlots bathe. That's what this says. Now, in verse 39, he built the ivory house. He built a fancy palace. His daddy Omri and Ahab were both known for their fancy building projects, very expensive. We found some of these inlaid furniture and inlaid ivory palace. It's mentioned in Amos chapter 3, verse 15 also. Notice we have the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. Then in verse 45, the books of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah. Here is an extra source that the author of 1 Kings is using. Notice it says he slept with his fathers. Now, of course, that's a metaphor for death in the Old Testament. And Ahaziah was his son. Ahaziah starts in 1 Kings and ends in 2 Kings. Shows it's a terrible place to break this. And verse 41 and following, we pick up the history of Jehoshaphat briefly. As you know, Kings goes back and forth. And this is picking up back in 1524. He was a godly king. He had done some good things. He had tried to get rid of the high places, but not completely. He tried to get rid of these male and female prostitutes down in verse 46. If you want to see that, it's 1512 is where his daddy tried to do it, but it wasn't successful. Then he tried to have them removed. Let's see. He tried to build some ships. Now, we're not sure if it's the ships of Tarshish, meaning the same kinds the Phoenicians has, or if it was ships from Tarshish. We're just not sure about that, going to Tarshish. It's obvious from the parallel, and the parallel, let me see, 2 Chronicles 20, verse 36, that he wanted to build a fleet, much like that Solomon had in the same place. And I'll see 1 Kings 9, 28. The parallel of this is 2 Chronicles 20, verse 35 and 37, and he's condemned, and the ships are destroyed because he made an alliance with the king of the north, who are all condemned because of their golden calf worship. Here again, God supernaturally destroys these ships, verse 48. in the Gulf of Aqaba at the northern end, the city of Ezron-Geber. Now, exactly what happened and why, we're not sure. But then in verse 51, we go back to the king of the north and shows that he was just as sinful as Jeroboam the first, which is probably this golden calf worship that turned into Baal worship, and all the kings of the north are condemned. Well, I'm sorry I had to go so fast through this long chapter, but I've enjoyed being with you.